From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Fighting for Your Culture and Home, we'll hear from writer Joe Kane. His new book, Savages, documents a bitter battle being waged by a small tribe of warriors against multinational oil companies, misguided environmentalists, and missionaries. Also, a conversation with one of the top brokers of the beauty business. Nina Blanchard headed one of the biggest modeling agencies in America. Now, after 34 years, she's had enough. And film critic Steven Weinberg reviews the newest James Bond installment, GoldenEye. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Today's deadline for wrapping up the Bosnian peace talks in Ohio has passed, but the talks continue. U.S. officials now say the negotiations between the Bosnians, Croats, and Serbs may continue well into the night. Congressional leaders are praising the short-term agreement that will allow the federal government to keep operating through December 15th, but one Republican senator and presidential candidate is not enthusiastic about the deal. New Hampshire Public Radio's Lita Hartman reports.
Speaking at the annual meeting of Republican governors in Nashua, New Hampshire, Phil Graham took aim at Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, his rival for the Republican presidential nomination. Graham predicted a split in Republican ranks if Dole agrees to negotiate on the economic assumptions that the budget is based on. Graham said such a compromise would simply result in more spending.
I am not going to sign on to a deal that recharges Bill Clinton's credit card. I am not going to sign on to a deal that lets Bill Clinton spend more money we don't have on programs that we can't afford.
Dole, who was in Washington, couldn't attend the governor's conference, but his aides responded that negotiation is part of the responsibility of leadership. For National Public Radio, I'm Lita Hartman in Nashua.
The Federal Aviation Administration has ordered the nation's airlines to step up inspections of a type of General Electric jet engine that's used on Boeing 747 and 767s, McDonnell Douglas DC-10 and MD-11s, and the Airbus A300 and A310. The National Transportation Safety Board recommended the inspections after a cracked part was found to be responsible for an engine failure in a DC-10. The United Nations Health Agency says thyroid cancer among children has increased up to 100 times in the area most exposed to radiation from the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Thyroid cancer in children is regarded as the fastest way to measure the impact of accidental radiation exposure because the disease is otherwise rare. Some 5 million people were exposed to radiation following the fire and explosion at Chernobyl in 1986. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed past the 5,000 mark for the first time ever today. Investment analyst Ed Riley of the Bank of Boston attributes the rise to growing consumer confidence and low interest rates.
The economic environment is quite benign in most people's expectations and interpretation. We have a very slow growth economy coupled with a very low inflation rate, which is an ideal scenario for the equity market. The only major underpinning that may be questioned as we move forward to 1996 is the corporate earnings outlook.
The Dow has now slipped back just below the 5,000 mark. The Dow is up 5 points at 49.95, an active trading of 255 million shares. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite is down 6.5. This is NPR. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a new drug for use in treating AIDS and HIV infection. It's called 3TC. It was approved for use in combination with the drug AZT. Researchers say 3TC appears to boost the immune system and lower the amount of virus in the patient's bloodstream. After 2 days of intense bargaining, the Boeing company and its largest union have reached a tentative agreement that may end the month-and-a-half-old strike by 30,000 production workers. Guy Nelson of member station KUOW in Seattle reports.
The machinist union will vote tomorrow on whether to accept the latest offer, which would include slightly higher wages, pensions, and better job security. The union has held out over the issue of subcontracting, which sent work outside the company. Boeing spokesman Russ Young says the aircraft maker made some concessions there.
Improved dialogue between the company and union on the issue. Also, some pre-notification when the company is planning to subcontract work And the opportunity for the union to present proposals for alternatives.
Boeing also lowered monthly contributions and deductibles for medical benefits. As part of the settlement, union officials agreed to withdraw two sets of unfair labor practice charges filed against the company. The new contract proposal covers workers in Washington, Kansas, Oregon, and California. For National Public Radio, this is Guy Nelson in Seattle.
A former Nazi SS captain was extradited from Argentina to Italy today to stand trial for his part in a World War II massacre of 335 civilians. 82-year-old Eric Priebke was accompanied by 10 Interpol officers and a military doctor as he boarded a flight to Rome. He's lived in Argentina for 50 years. Priebke has been under house arrest for the past year after admitting in a TV interview that he participated in the killings. He said his task was to cross off the names of the people as they were led to execution. He says he was just following orders. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, in for Terry Gross. When Joe Kane traveled the Amazon 10 years ago, he was shot at, suffered malaria, and came close to drowning many times. He chronicled his journey down that treacherous river in his first book, Running the Amazon. Kane went back to the Amazon in the early 90s, this time to the rainforest deep inside Ecuador, to find a small nomadic tribe of warriors called the Huarani. They were in a fight with the multinational oil companies that were polluting and damaging their land while producing oil in the region. Kane lived and traveled with the Huarani, seeing firsthand the environmental impact of oil exploration on the rainforest and on their way of life. He befriended a tribe leader named Moy, who was invited to Washington by the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. In his new book, Savages, Kane tells of meeting with Moy in Washington. While in the city, Kane took him to see the White House.
At the White House gate, Moy reached into his bag and carefully removed his crown. It was made from owl, eagle, toucan, parrot, and wild turkey feathers. And when he jammed it down on his jet-black hair, a thousand colors seemed to burst from the plumes. But the gate was closed, and for a long time Moy stood and stared silently through the iron fence. Then he said, "That house looks pretty small. Are you sure the government lives there?" And I said, "The president lives here with his family." "But where are the soldiers? Are they underground?" "Probably," I said, "and in back, and inside." He gripped the fence as if testing its strength, and his eyes narrowed in calculation. He went into the Huarani zone, as I'd come to think of it. When he returned, he said, "I believe I can climb this fence and reach the front door before the soldiers get me." "It will not work, Moy. It will not work if I do not try," he said. And I said, "The soldiers will be on you like a boa on a tree rat." And he said, "I will climb the trees and hide. I will pretend I am hunting monkeys." But I dissuaded him, at least for the moment, and we walked on. The sidewalks were full. Traffic roared. "There are so many cars," he said. "How long have they been here? 1,000,000 years? "Much less," I said. 1,000 years. "No," I answered. 80, perhaps. He was silent then, but after a while he asked, "What will you do in 10 more years? In 10 years your world will be pure metal. Did your God do this?" Dusk turned to night, and as we approached our hotel, Moy stopped beneath the street lamp. He pointed to the street. "More people, more cars, more petroleum, more chaos," he said. Then he pointed straight up at the light. "But there are the Huarani, all alone in the middle of the world."
That's Joe Kane reading from his book, Savages. Moy had been brought to the States by the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and they wanted him to testify before the Human Rights Commission of the Organization of American States. What did he want to say to that commission?
He wanted to say to the commission that oil companies, and specifically American oil companies, threatened to destroy the Huarani way of life. And he wanted the commission to come down and investigate, or as Moy put it, he said he wanted the whole world to see. He felt that if the whole world came down and saw what was happening to the Huarani in the forest, that people would stop it.
Was Moy persuasive at all with the commission?
Moy floored the commission. The only mistake he made was that we had practiced in the hotel the night before. He had written out a speech he wanted to make, but he was reading it. And he can write it about a third or fourth grade level in our terms. And I told him, "No, Moy, don't. Just speak as you naturally would." And he said, "Yes, speak like the jaguar," because the jaguar is really the most powerful being for the Huarani in the forest. And I said, "Yes, use your own words." And so when he spoke to the commission, he leapt out of the seat with the power of his oratory. But he spoke entirely in Huarani, which none of the commission could understand. And then somebody leaned over and said, "Okay, great, now say it in Spanish," which he did, and then was very persuasive. And the commission all leaned forward, And afterwards, everybody wanted to talk to him. And Moy had, you know, brought various things with him that he had hoped to sell for a dollar or two here to raise transportation money going home. And he just gave it all away, spears, string bags, whatever he had.
Did he wear his crown?
He wore his crown. He brought a spear. He brought his blowgun. He brought blowgun darts. And he also wore a suit jacket and a sports shirt and tie and pants and shoes, which for him were like a costume. He loved it. They were coyote clothes, as he called them, cannibal clothes, the clothes he wore when he came to talk to cannibals, which the Guarani considered to be everyone outside their territory but them.
Well, you had first met Moy 2.5 years before that. You were actually working at the Rainforest Action Network, and this rather mysterious letter appeared at the network. Describe the circumstances of its arrival.
Well, it came out of nowhere, it seemed. I was at the Rainforest Action Network a day or two a month helping them out with their newsletter. I happened to be there one day when Randy Hayes, the director of RAN, found this piece of paper on his desk in a stack of other papers and pulled it out. It came in an envelope with no postmark and no return address. It was typewritten on a manual typewriter on a single piece of white paper, plain white paper. And Hayes couldn't read it because it was in Spanish, which he doesn't speak, so he brought it to me. At that time, DuPont and Conoco, a subsidiary of DuPont, had finished exploring an area of the Ecuadorian Amazon for oil, and they discovered 220 million barrels, which they proposed to extract over 20 years. They had invested $90 million in the exploration and were about a month or two short of making a decision on whether or not to go ahead with production, in which case they'd sink 120 wells and put in over 100 miles of road, et cetera, et cetera.
So what did the letter say?
Well, the letter said the Guarani were opposed to oil exploitation in their territory, and they said the company DuPont and others were discussing the lives of the Guarani in meetings in which the Guarani are not present. And it said that the Guarani would defend their land with spears from all sides because we are the bravest people in the Amazon.
Now, had you ever heard of the Guarani before you had traveled the length of the Amazon River a couple of years beforehand?
No, I had been through Peru and Brazil, and I did not run into the Guarani then. They're extremely isolated. There's only about 1,300 of them, and they have defended a territory the size of Massachusetts for as long as anyone knows. They're considered the fiercest forest people on the planet. They're spear killers. In fact, they're so isolated that their language is unrelated to any other on Earth, although, as I was to come and find out, some of the younger men speak Spanish. They've picked it up on their travels. The word Guarani had come up, and in fact, there are at least a dozen environmental and human rights groups involved in this campaign, either opposing DuPont, Conoco, or in some cases actually working with them, as it turned out, in secret negotiations to confer the stamp of approval in exchange for a large foundation that would be set up. I called around to all these groups. Nobody could tell me how to get in touch with the Guarani. Nobody could offer any way of finding out whether that letter was for real or not. It was potentially a very powerful letter. So I left RAN, got an assignment from The New Yorker, and went down to Ecuador. The one clue we had was on the dateline on the letter said Coca, which is a little western, wild west sort of town in the Ecuadorian Amazon. I flew into Quito and then down into Coca. And started to look for the Guarani.
Well, let's find out how you got there, because this is certainly where part of your adventure begins. You had the name of this town, Coca.
Coca.
Coca. And you had, I guess, some idea about how the Amazon works from your previous travels. Mm-hmm. But where did you begin? Where do you go when you don't have a detailed map to work off of?
Well, I had heard the story of Alejandro Labaca, a Capuchin monk. In 1987, Braspetro, the Brazilian national oil company, and apparently Texaco, well, it's not clear if Texaco is involved, but they're said to have been. In any case, they spotted the Tagiri, one of the fiercest of the Guarani clans. They spotted a Tagiri settlement by air and then sent a team of mercenaries after the Tagiri to clear them out of the oil zone. There was a skirmish. A couple of Tagiri apparently were killed. Some of the mercenaries were injured. And Alejandro Labaca, the bishop of Coca, heard about this. And Labaca had learned some Guarani from clans he had met on the edges of the territory. And he went to the oil companies and the military and said, look, please let me intervene and try to move the Tagiri away rather than have you kill them. So Conoco dropped Labaca in the Tagiri clearing, came back 3 days later and found his body pinned to the ground with 17 palmwood spears, each of them jutting out of his corpse like porcupine quills. His body had been punctured in 89 places, and of course he was dead. I had heard that story, so I went to the Capuchin mission, and I happened to meet Labaca's best friend, a priest named Jose Miguel Goldaras, who still had the 17 spears taken from Labaca's body, and I said, look, we got this letter. I'm trying to find out if it's real. How can I meet the Guarani? And he kind of studied me, And he said, "You want to meet the Guarani?" And he said, "They're right over there." And he pointed to the back of the mission compound, and there was this funky little cinder block shed. And I walked over and knocked on the door, and a voice said in Spanish, "Are you coming here?" And so I said, "Well, yes, I'm coming here." And the door opened, and I walked in, and there were a half dozen young men sitting there wearing T-shirts and blue jeans, not saying a word, just watching me. And one of them had a pair of headphones on, and he had a wire going from the headphones down to his right hip pocket. And to make conversation, I asked him in Spanish, I said, "What are you listening to?" And he looked at me very solemnly, and he said, "I am listening to my pants."
Did the guy have a Walkman?
No, he just had the headphones.
He
wore the headphones. They were not connected to anything at all. He had the wire, and he tucked into his pants and just wore them around because he thought they were cool. And the joke was on me.
Absolutely. Joe Kane is our guest. His book is called Savages, and it's about a small tribe living in the Amazon called the Guarani, and it's about their fight to preserve their land and culture against oil companies, missionaries, and even environmental groups. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Kane, and his book is called Savages. You have an interesting photograph in your book. It's actually comparing your feet to the feet of a Guarani. And what's most striking is the fact that they have this, what could be described as an opposable toe, just the way you can move your thumb down. It looks as if they can move their toe down, or perhaps it's even permanently extended.
Well, they call themselves tree walkers. They spend as much as half their lives, waking lives up in the canopy, because that's where so much of the life of the rainforest is. And their feet over time adapt to walking on tree branches, or, for example, crossing rivers. They'll knock down a 40-foot tall tree, knock it over a raging river, and then use it as a bridge and just walk across the log, carrying, you know, up to 100 pounds at a time, and never fall off. And their feet curl so well around the trees, the trunks and branches, Well, you could call it a deformity, but it's really an adaptation to a need.
What does Guarani sound like? Can you give us some words just to get us give us a feel?
What do I still remember? It's been a while. Mbotogobopa, which means basically "I am coming here." It's kind of it's very nasal. And so my name, for example, they would try to say Joe,
right,
but it would come out Chong. So they just started calling me Chong all the time.
Well, I thought some interesting things about their language was you said the word for anxiety is the same word for kill, and that the word later didn't come until, I guess, the missionaries came.
Yeah, well, actually, what didn't come until the missionaries came was the word lazy. Later was a concept that the Guarani, you'd ask them, I brought a bunch of food with me into the territory once because I thought we'd be doing a long trek and I wanted to make sure there was enough. And the Guarani, of course, insisted that I break it all out, and they ate the whole thing. 3 weeks' supplies we ate in 3 days. It was just gone. And I said, "Geez, shouldn't we save some for later?" And they just looked at me and said, "Well, what's later? I mean, you know, there's no refrigeration, for example. So the idea of keeping food or keeping anything makes no sense to them. There's no sense of hoarding within the culture. There's no place to hide anything. And the Guarani ideal is self-sufficiency. The idea is to be so in tune with the abundance of the forest that you can go out there and find whatever you need and support yourself that way. So there is no need to save things for later.
Did you learn when you were with them to live in the present tense? Because, boy, I think that's so hard to do if you live in our culture.
Yeah, no. I can't say that. I was always worried about what was going to happen next, for example. But it is something that I brought away from the Guarani, my experience there, which is that the Guarani do live so in the moment. I realize that's a cliche these days, but it's absolutely true, and they have to. There is so much going on around them in the forest all the time that they can't afford not to pay attention. And so their ability to concentrate and to see clearly is extraordinary and very inspiring. And I would see it translated when they came into, as they called it, my camp. After a while, the younger men were coming into the city and they would want to have a cannibal contact there. And I was, at one point, the only person they knew in Quito. You know, they would ride the buses up out of the territory using their spears for tickets. They knew if they made some spears that whenever anybody asked them for a ticket for the bus, they could just hand over a spear and that would work. And they would come to my camp, and then they would hike through the city, and they'd hike in single file like we were in a hunting out on a hunting party. And we would go hunting at the local supermarket, the Supermaxi, as it was called, and we would stalk, you know, frozen chickens and bring them back, carrying them on our heads back to my place. But always the Warani were watching, you know, watching, studying everything. And then they would come back and they could mimic all the people they had met. They could talk. For example, they did a great job of mimicking petroleum engineers, who have a certain way of talking, or of people like me, you know, writers coming down asking questions. They were just excellent students.
Well, you describe a trip that deep into the forest where you literally felt like you were starving to death. You were lost. You had hypothermia. Did you think, I'm not going to make it? I'm just not going to make it out of here?
Yes. I spent one whole night in particular knowing I was starving to death. We were on a trek, so we weren't hunting. And in any case, the Warani can go for 8 to 10 days without eating anything and then sit down and at a single sitting eat 8 to 10 pounds of meat, a single adult Warani male. So they can go. I couldn't. You know, I wasn't adapted for that. And we hadn't eaten for at least 4 days and were hiking a lot, you know, 20, 25 miles a day sometimes.
And this is pretty rigorous hiking, I can imagine.
In rainforest, yeah, in hilly rainforest, slippery, slimy, all kinds of things biting you all the time, and you're hacking your way through the bush as you go, and you hike from dawn till dark. And we were lost, and the Warani were lost. We were outside the territory they knew, and we had to cut down trees. We had come to a river, the trail had ended, we were at a river, and we had to float that river, and we didn't know if we were going further into Warani territory, in which case we might find help, or if we were going south and east toward Peru, in which case we could go for weeks without coming across any other people.
Is it pretty unusual for the Warani to get lost?
They get lost, but they don't see it as lost, and they expect that something will happen. The Warani are very, they're very realistic. As Nkeri said to me at that point, I asked him, I said, Nkeri, where are we? And he said, we are in the forest. Hmm. I said, yes, but where in the forest? And he said, well, I can't find the trail. And I said, what does that mean? And he says, well, it means we're lost. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, it means we might die. And it was a simple statement of fact, no hysteria attached to it, on his part anyway. And then we built our rafts, and 2 days later, some Warani found us in a canoe. They said they had been out on a hunting party and had this canoe piled high with monkey and wild boar, well, peccary actually, banana and manioc. And I asked them, I said, how did you find us? And they said, you can't hide anything from the Warani. And this is the sense they have, that even if they're lost, that they will figure something out. And they thought it was hilarious that we'd almost died. And, of course, every Warani I was hiking with had to tell the story about, you know, the cannibal who fell off the bridges, made little fluttering signs with their hands, and they all found that hysterical.
Well, I like the stories you tell about how they tell time, because I think it shows both their humor but also their ability to take in the outside culture and adapt it for their own.
Yeah, they... Well, in Kerry, for example, when he was one of the Warani men I got to know very well, Moy and Nanto being the others, and they're really who I write about in the book. But in Kerry was the first Warani I traveled with, and in Koke, he'd had me buy him an outfit for the forest, which was a camouflage hat, a faux Yves Saint Laurent belt, a pair of men's BVDs, and some cotton socks and some rubber boots. And that was it. That made him the coolest dude in the forest. And so I was, you know, setting off on this massive trek following a man in his underpants. But Nkeri already had a watch, and it didn't work, of course. I'm sure somebody had thrown it away or just given it to him because it was broken. But he would announce, you know, he would read it, and Moy would do it too. I'd ask him, what time is it? And they would say, it's 12 o'clock in Ecuador. It's 1 o'clock in the United States of North America. It's 2 o'clock in France. It's 3 o'clock in Japan. And it was this joke about, you know, keeping time by the hours. And even out trekking in the forest, Nkeri very seriously would announce, you know, today we will hike until 5 minutes after five. And of course, his watch didn't work. And I would ask him, Nkeri, when will it be 5 minutes after five? And he would say, in 1 hour and a half. And then we would hike for 8, 9, 10 hours. And he would announce out of nowhere, 5 minutes after five, you know, very seriously. And then we would make camp. But now in terms of, say, days, that was a different story. Mm. If I would see Moy or see Nkeri in the territory and I'd be leaving, you know, Nkeri would say, you know, Chong, I will come to your camp in 22 days. I would say, okay, great. Will you be alone? And always, yes, I'll be alone. Then 22 days later, I would return. I would be at my apartment after, say, doing errands in Quito, and I'd return home, and there would be, you know, 6 or 12 or 18 Warani standing out in front of the apartment, wearing their spears and their headdresses, scaring the bejesus out of the local folks just by their appearance, but right on time, 22 days. And they'd be there waiting for me, and then I would take them up into my camp where they would then start ransacking my apartment because, you know, I was clan by that point, so anything I had was theirs. You know, for Warani, the highest manifestation of that ideal state of self-sufficiency was to give away whatever you had because you had no fear of need. So they would come out wearing all my clothes, all my great cannibal nylon jackets and things like that, always holding things up and saying, is this waterproof? Is this waterproof? Is this waterproof? And then wearing my ties wrapped around their heads like crowns.
Let's talk a little bit about what the petroleum companies are doing deep in the Amazon rainforest. And this is an area rich in oil and a country in Ecuador that wants oil companies to come to their country because they have a huge foreign debt.
Yes, it's a country, let's put it this way, that certain parts of the country, which happens to be the leadership, wants oil, although there's growing resentment within the country about it. A graffito that you see a lot there is más pobreza equal sign, más petróleo equals más pobreza.
Meaning?
More petroleum equals more poverty. Texaco especially has been down there for 20 years. When the oil boom started and Texaco started it, it produced its first commercial oil in Ecuador in 1972. At that time, Ecuador was $300 million in debt. It had $300 million of international debt. After 20 years of oil boom, Ecuador now has an international debt of $12.5 billion. If you trace the graph of oil production and the graph of national debt, they're exactly parallel, or almost parallel. And after 20 years, you can't say it's an aberration. It's clear that the more oil that Ecuador produces, the further in debt it goes. The money, they call the money down there 24-hour dollars. It comes in from the United States, it's, you know, in terms of in loans and such. And then it goes right back to the United States. It goes into personal bank accounts of the ruling elite. It goes into Swiss bank accounts often as well, and sometimes German bank accounts. And so the country, you know, most of the people down there realize that they're essentially their oil supply is being looted, and there is growing resentment about it.
So what do the Waorani want?
They know, as most people do, that you know, oil production will not stop. It's not realistic. But they want a moratorium until the technology is brought up to snuff. Most of the Indian groups in the Oriente know that there's much better technology employed in the United States because the United States has laws that address contamination. And they want American oil companies to at least use that technology in the Amazon. And they want the oil companies and the missionaries out of their own cultural process. They don't want missionary schools in their territory. They don't want oil company schools in their territory. They want Waorani in their territory. They want schools, but they want to run through the state's bicultural, bilingual education program. In other words, in which they would not only learn Spanish, but also Waorani, traditional Waorani culture would also be taught so that the ways of the parents would be remembered.
Well, Joe Kane, thank you very much for joining us today on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Joe Kane's book is entitled Savages. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a look inside the world of high fashion from somebody who's lived it. Nina Blanchard headed one of the nation's top modeling agencies. Her novel, The Look, is based heavily on her experiences. Also, film critic Steven Weinberg reviews GoldenEye, the new James Bond film with a new James Bond. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Nina Blanchard knows a pretty face when she sees one. Blanchard ran her own modeling agency on the West Coast for nearly 35 years and is credited with making Cheryl Teagues, Sherry Belafonte, and Christie Brinkley household names. She gave Sharon Stone and Renee Russo their start in modeling before they went on to acting. Nina Blanchard called it quits last spring, saying she was exhausted, worn out by the constant pressure to feed the fashion industry's hunger for a new face. She sold her super agency to Ford Models, and she's just written her first book, a novel called The Look. It's a fictional account of the high-pressure, high-stakes world of modeling. One of the characters in the book is a successful agent like Nina Blanchard named Jessica Cartwright. The novel begins with Cartwright parked in a limo outside a newsstand, watching the public buy up the fashion magazines that feature her models on their covers.
The excitement of seeing your discovery on the cover of a magazine, particularly a big magazine, is the most exciting thing about the business, because it's not just that you're excited for her to be truthful about it, it just validates me, you know, to be honest.
Well, Jessica questions her profession, feeling that perhaps it's promoting a kind of image, a kind of beauty that's really problematic. I'm curious when you began to question what it was that you were doing and what it was about this industry that you were involved in.
Well, I probably began, in all truth, I began to question it when I got older. Because the girls were getting younger, I was getting older. And it really does, it gets to you. There isn't any question. You might say, listen, you're an intelligent, educated woman. What is your problem with this? You don't have to worry about these young girls. Well, that ain't true. The fact is that you don't, it's hard to go in every day. And this is a very, I don't care whether, it's not vain, it's not vanity. It just has to do with, I don't want to look at them anymore. You know, they're so young, and I don't know of anything that can stop that process. And you can't look at them and say, oh, she'll get old, because you might not be around by the time she gets old enough for you not to worry about it anymore.
So you really felt a kind of uncomfortableness looking at yourself, I guess, in the mirror.
No question.
And then looking at these young beauties.
Whether I should admit that or not, I don't care. It's the truth.
Well, let me start in the beginning then. You started your modeling agency in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think your talents were?
I tell you what I think. I've often wondered. The only thing an agent does is you have to be able to spot a face. If you don't have that, you will never, ever be an agent of any import. It just won't happen.
Let me just stop you there. What does that mean, then, to spot a face?
It means that you can look, you have to look at the girl and the picture. And if you look at the picture first, if you see something, if you understand that she's photogenic, and you feel that there's something in the eyes, something in the face, something that jumps out at you from the picture, it has to jump out at you, then you will do everything to get a hold of that girl. Now, where did I get that? You know, I don't know, because I was a lousy artist. It didn't come from that. It probably came, I think, as I look back on it, from the 8 years that I spent sitting in control rooms in the early days in New York City at NBC.
You talk about a model being photogenic, and I know that there's that sort of subjective and probably hard to describe quality that somebody has when they're photogenic. Is it more important to look good on a page or look good in person if you're a model?
On a page. No, it's really not that subjective, because being photogenic really has to do with the shape of the skull. Because if you even think about some of the great stars, male or female, it's like the great Garbo, you know, I always talked about her cheekbones. all the great stars from Errol Flynn, all of those men that had that great look. It's the way the light hits the bones in the face. And if you have a wonderfully darling, round, chubby face, it ain't gonna happen at all. You just don't have the bones. The skull, the shape of the skull is wrong. Not wrong, but it doesn't photograph the same way as the one that has the planes in the face.
What would you say is the difference between a model and a supermodel? What makes somebody a supermodel?
Well, the girl that becomes the supermodel is the one that is able to sell product. You know, if someone does an ad for Estee Lauder, Revlon, whomever, and a lot of the great supermodels have gotten, you know, do cosmetic contracts. But if that product just absolutely runs off the shelf when she's in the ad, then she gets up into that supermodel category. Plus the fact that people are willing to pay rather enormous sums for her.
The Calvin Klein ads have really pushed the envelope, and, mm-hmm. and the ones I'm talking about are the ones that show teenagers in provocative
yes.
sexual yeah. poses.
Right.
What are your thoughts about that?
My attitude about the ads is it's not the lack of clothing, it's not the fact that it's some underwear. It has to do with the poses. And I think that I think those are poses. I personally find them offensive. Love Calvin's clothes. I like Calvin. But I found them offensive, but it obviously sold jeans.
My guest is agent-turned-novelist Nina Blanchard. Her book is called The Look. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Nina Blanchard. Her novel, The Look, is about the fashion industry. I'm curious about how much plastic surgery you think goes on in the modeling industry. It certainly goes on in the regular world as well, but it offers the option. It doesn't make you 6'2", but it certainly can change your features around.
Well, you know, when I was first in the business, I remember having a long talk with an editor of Vogue. And she said, you know, we do not like to work with girls that have had plastic surgery. We don't like particularly nose jobs because they're always obvious. And she was right. Very few girls that have had their noses changed ever managed to get into the upper echelon. However, the biggest, you know, plastic surgery, certainly breast enhancement, there's an enormous amount of that. I try to discourage it because a number of the girls that have had it have had some bad results and have had to have them removed. Not all of them. But does it increase their, if a girl is not concave, but if she's small, and she has breast enhancement, as they call it, will she work more? There's no question she'll work more.
But that's different. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that the Twiggy stage when women were paper thin, certainly twig thin, and had almost no breasts, a very boyish look.
There was a look, but, you know, the whole country didn't do that because the whole country never does. It's what we see in the media. It's what we see in the magazines. Now, we can look at Kate Moss. Now, Kate doesn't starve herself. She's a beautiful young woman. That's the weight that she is. And Twiggy was, I think, a little bit thinner even than Kate. But you don't see women across the United States go out. You know, I just came from Ohio. And you go into a mall there, you don't see girls looking like Twiggy. And I don't think they really want to. So there's, you know, the fashion industry basically is New York, Milan, Paris, and all the big German catalogs are shot on South Beach in Miami now, which is strange, but they are. And Los Angeles, and then the smaller markets like Dallas and Chicago. But there's a whole other country in there that, you know, is not what we look at. Once you get into this fashion industry, you get an attitude where you look at clothing and you say, ugh, what bad taste. You have to break away from that because it becomes terribly... It isn't that good taste is not important. I think it is, because what does dressing well mean? What does looking good mean? It means you've got a good arrangement of color and space, and you have things that, you know, you look good. I think some of the American women dress like toads because I don't think they care. But the fact is that a lot of them, the fashion magazines, do not teach them anything. They never have, and they probably never will.
What do you think, though, about the kinds of standards that the modeling industry sets? And it's hard not to be influenced by it, whether you're just standing in line at the checkout counter and you're looking at the faces on the
right.
covers of all those magazines. You're actually buying the magazines and looking at them. It's hard not to feel that you don't measure up.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think that you have to understand what it's about, what fashion is about. Fashion is about big business. Fashion is about money. Fashion is not really about fashion. That's what it's about. The magazines, if you look even at the best of the fashion magazines, you see what keeps them going. It's not their subscriptions, it's the advertising. If the advertising wasn't in there, if you go through, you manage to come to the editorial section after about 50 pages or 60 pages of advertising. The editorial section is not that big. They have some interesting ads, I mean some interesting stories. But it's not about anything but money. It's about selling cosmetics. It's about selling clothing.
But as a consumer, you can't get past the fact that the products are draped on these people whose looks seem almost impossible to have.
I totally agree with you. And the only comment I have, and I find it a problem, but if, let's say they were to, and a lot of women complain, if I do lectures, they'll say, oh, they always use these young, pretty girls, and, you know, they don't have any lines, and blah. However, what if we were to take those women and put them in the clothes or put them in with the cosmetics, a woman, let's say, in her 40s or 50s, because she's the woman that buys the cosmetics. It's not the young girl that buys the expensive cosmetics. And it's not the young girl in high school that buys Valentino. So what if we put them in the clothes and put them on the pages of the magazine? What would we sell?
What do you think?
Nothing.
Because it's a fantasy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what it's about. I mean, you can't think, if you think about some of your, well, let's say your neighbors or coworkers, the people that go and buy these things, and or just any average woman. Well, why don't they use average women, some of the women say to me? Because you wouldn't sell anything if you used people. Let's say I buy clothing or I buy cosmetics. If I saw me in an ad, I ain't going to buy it. Not for a minute.
Well, I'm still stuck on the way these models look. And do any of them look as good in real life as they do on the pages after they've had their makeup and their hair done and they're dressed in beautiful, expensive clothing and the lighting is absolutely perfect?
Oh, of course they do. Absolutely. There is no question that there are some, you know, some of the models, this is just not all paint and paste. The face is there. Now, they may, with the makeup off, of course, they don't look like the cover of Vogue or any of these ads that they've been in, but that's a symmetrical, lovely face. I mean, I represented Sharon Stone for 10 years. And Sharon, I mean, that is a beautiful face, whether she has makeup on or no makeup on. Rene Russo, makeup or no makeup, a gorgeous face. Cheryl Teagues, some of the young 14, 15-year-olds. Kate Moss without makeup. It's an attractive face. It's a photogenic face. Yes, they do look. People say, oh, she didn't look good at all without her makeup. They're not ugly without their makeup. Because people think that, oh, it's all makeup. I mean, I could look like that with makeup. Well, that's not true. You can't. You just can't.
You just got out of the fashion industry, decided to call it quits. Was there some event that made you realize that you'd had enough?
Yeah, there were a couple of events. I think that I got very tired of, you know, the first 10 years in the business, I had a lot of fun. I wasn't very rich. I didn't have any money, but I had a lot of fun. The second 10 years, I started becoming very successful, making a lot of money. And the last 10 years, the last 14 years, actually, you just kind of have to put your back up against a wall and keep it there, because otherwise you're going to get knifed. And I found that it wasn't any fun anymore. It really was not fun, not for me. Because it's totally driven by money now, totally driven. And I think what I call the I wants that some of the agents have, and the extent of the size of their greed lets them do things that is so terrible. It's not just greed. They want that star. They try to, models move from one agency to another, and you just say, ah, is it this going to be this kind of damn turmoil all day long? And it reached a point where when you reach a point and you just don't want to go in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The only thing that I found exciting, again, was new face would come in, and I could get on the phone right away and say, you know, Jim, you've got to see this girl. She's spectacular. But I think also a lot of it, I was a good agent. An agent can only find, they don't get you the work. What they do is find the outlet for you, and they negotiate. That's what an agent does.
Do you miss anything about the industry?
Oh, sure I do. Of course I do. I miss a lot of things that I miss. There's certain people in the industry that I adored. I had great fun with a lot of them. There were people that I would talk to on the phone, some of the photographers with great sense of humor. And there were certain things in the office during the day. There would be funny things that would happen. And there used to be a kid that would come in. He came in about every 3 days, and he had this kind of bizarre dyed orange hair. Very unattractive guy. And the first time he came in, and I don't remember how it started. He used to come in and say, anything for me today, Nina? I'd say, not today, honey. You know, I have no idea who he was. He was some kind of a lunatic from the streets. And there were things that were humorous, that were fun. And some of the things the agents did that you just didn't believe. And all of that stuff that went on. And there were a lot of the kids, when they used to drop by the agency all the time. And they were fun. You know, they had... Mm-hmm. There was laughter, and that there's a lot of stuff that I miss about it. I don't miss. See, a lot of these kids have a lot of pain when it isn't happening anymore. You know, and it is so hard to say to a model, "Well, now this, what's happening with my career? I'm not getting any work. I don't want to say to her, you're too old, because no one wants you anymore. You can't do that. So you let her come in and say, I'm going to get a better agent." Say, well, gee, I really understand, honey, because I can't do it. And that is really hard. The hardest part was to say no to these kids that came in. It just took its toll on me.
Well, Nina Blanchard, we are out of time, and I thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Nina Blanchard's novel is called The Look. Coming up, a review of the new James Bond film. Here's the classic theme from an older one.
short finger beckons you to enter his web of sin. Kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
That's Shirley Bassey on Fresh Air. The James Bond series returns with a new James Bond, Pierce Brosnan, and looks for a place in the post-Cold War landscape. In GoldenEye, Bond is pitted against a former British agent gone bad. And this time around, Bond has a woman for a boss, and his romantic interest is a computer whiz.
The James Bond pictures may be the most beloved series movies have ever given us, and the sturdiest. The offspring of the Cold War and the op art era, it survived Vietnam, the departure of Sean Connery, and Ronald Reagan. The 90s have made the Soviet villain type obsolete, but still the series continues with GoldenEye. And with a brand new Bond, Pierce Brosnan, easily outdistancing his predecessor, Timothy Dalton. The movie isn't a classic Bond, but some of it's fun. The filmmakers, director Martin Campbell and writers Jeffrey Kane and Bruce Feirstein, approach this post-Cold War Bond democratically. The two baddies who bomb a Siberian weapons center and kill everyone in sight so they can steal a legendary Russian satellite known as GoldenEye are Russians. But the mastermind is a Brit, a vengeful ex-MI6 agent, long thought dead, played by Sean Bean. The movie tries to have it both ways, to darken the tone while still furnishing the glossy spectacle we all expect from a Bond. So the lanky Russian villainess, played by Famke Janssen, climaxes while she dispatches her victims. And there are a few witty action set pieces, one of which is so outrageous that the audience applauds at the end. The wit is more in the conception and the staging than in the filming. Campbell goes in for big, violent explosions that numb our senses. But whenever Bean shows up, the film turns somber. His character dips into the annals of English history to justify his treason, and waxes philosophical about the way the British Secret Service uses and disposes of its manpower. The script kids Bond for being a dinosaur, but Bean's cynical outbursts are the real fossils. They come to us from Graham Greene via John le Carré.
Alec?
Back from the dead. No longer just an anonymous star on the memorial wall at MI6. What's the matter, James? No glib remark? No pithy comeback?
Why?
Hilarious question. Particularly from you. Did you ever ask why? Why we toppled all those dictators, undermined all those regimes? Only to come home. Well done, good job, but sorry, old boy. Everything you risked your life and limb for has changed.
It was the job we were chosen for.
Of course you'd say that. James Bond, Her Majesty's loyal terrier, defender of the so-called faith. Oh, please, James, put it away.
I can't think of a single serious moment that succeeded in a Bond picture since the death of Diana Rigg at the end of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. But the Sean Bean character doesn't sink GoldenEye. Director Campbell propels the film across its miles of plot. And though it would be an exaggeration to say that Pierce Brosnan brings depth to the role of the drip-dry hero, he does suggest a human being behind the mordant puns and the preposterous stunts. And he wears Bond's patina comfortably. He's aided by an unusually lively supporting cast that includes brief appearances by Robbie Coltrane and Joe Don Baker in comic roles. I enjoyed a sequence where Isabella Scorupco, who plays the heroine and love interest, sidesteps one disaster after another in the devastated weapons silo. Scorupco, as the Russian computer expert, is the brainiest match the series has ever found for Bond. GoldenEye makes a further nod at affirmative action by casting a woman as the latest M. The wise choice is in giving the part to silken-voiced Judi Dench. These performers counter the heavy-handed Sean Bean scenes. They deliver James Bond revisionism with a light heart.
Steve Weinberg contributes to the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. Danny Miller is Fresh Air's senior producer. The engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Alan Tu directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from New York Times reporter Roger Cohen on the prospects for peace in the former Yugoslavia. Join us for the next Fresh Air.